Hello there, you're listening to the Watson's Daily Podcast with me, Peter Watson, on Monday, the 8th of April. Today, I am joined by Saya Deb, who is a Watson's Daily subscriber. Hey there, Saya, how are you doing today?
Hi, Peter, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yep, all good, thank you. Although I have been recovering from having shot 284 zombies yesterday in a virtual reality experience. Unfortunately, I myself died 18 times, which was a bit strange, you know, a bit of a strain, but I'm okay today.
It's not ideal.
I did it with the family though, so we all did it together. So I think actually one of my kids said, "Oh, at least if we die, we all die together." Oh my God, that's a bit dark.
One way to look at it.
Anyway, right. So, what story did you pick out from today's Watson's Daily then?
I picked the story from the Financial Times.
Yep.
The Wall Street banks have warned that relocating operations and hiring in if the law isn't changed to limit redundancy cost for highly paid traders. I think that such high redundancy costs are proving quite problematic for US investment banks who want to move their financial services to Paris. Because obviously banking is standardised across Europe, and now that London has left the EU, Paris is a much more attractive location. You know, in the investment banking industry, there's a lot of hiring and firing. I think that this is quite a significant issue right now. Even more significant because these are really highly paid individuals. You know, we're looking at seven-figure salaries here. Limiting the redundancy payouts is going to be essential in order to control costs for these investment banks. What do you think about?
Firstly, the people they talk about is traders. A lot of these people get paid a lot of money. I think when you start in trading, you don't get loads. I mean, it's pretty good, but it's not loads. But then once you start getting experienced and good and rated, then suddenly it goes up a lot. I think that for investment banks, I think that sending people to the continent, particularly France and Germany, has often been seen as a bit problematic because the employment laws in those countries are very protective of employees and make it much more expensive and difficult to fire anyone. What the difference, employing locals in those markets, but in terms of costs. But I do know that obviously they will have those protections, as normal. But anyway, it's always been a problem for the investment banks. And when you consider the dire sort of warnings of a hollowing out of the investment banking industry when Brexit happens, actually, when you think about it, not that many people really in the scheme of things have been transferred over there. What do you think?
Oh yeah, I agree. You know, I think there's only 1,600 bankers that would Paris, you know, grand scheme of thing, that's really nothing. I think that France are really keen on attracting these banks to Paris.
So
that motivation to change labour laws. But I think that this is really hard to do just for one sector of the industry. I think there's also that level of French Parliament as well. Opposition parties aren't as motivated to support Macron's initiatives. Because obviously it would be a great success for him and his centrist political party if achieved. I think there's some difficulty, in actually implementing this change.
I think the thing is that this is all part of efforts by Macron to try and make France an attractive, attractive and viable alternative to the city. And although, you know, maybe it's going to be difficult for him to change the law per se that covers everyone, I really would have thought that it's more likely to be able to, if he's going to be able to get some sort of exception via the financial sector, although, you know, he'll carve something out, although that's not going to go down well within the industry, you know, within the individuals themselves. I would imagine the broader public are not going to have much sympathy with you know, bankers and get them getting, let's say, I don't know, 5 million euros compensation for being sacked. So
yeah.
So I you know, it's an interesting one. It's been perennial. I mean, I think the one thing that has always I've always found fascinating is how, you know, still the city remains a magnet for people that want to work in finance, despite all the Brexit stuff. But I think the thing is that there is a long history here. It has attracted some really brilliant people. And I mean, I certainly feel myself that the thing that I miss the most about working in the city is actually the people.
Yeah.
Now, not all of them were not that nice. Well, there were a lot of nice ones, right? But you know, not only, but they were so interesting to work with, such fascinating, you know, really sharp, really I mean, way more intelligent than me, and just really, I don't know. It's a really buzzy place, a really buzzy place to work, and I think people like that.
Yeah.
So I think they will continue to be attracted to that, but obviously, you know, France and Germany, I'm sure, you know, they'll do, and I suppose the Netherlands to an extent as well, you know, they will do their level best to try to get people away from London, but it still seems that London has an enduring appeal.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the no bonus cap as well, I think that will mean that Europeans will want to come to London even more.
Oh yeah.
I think that, you know, even if they do this in Paris, I'm not sure if it will be enough to stop Europeans wanting to come to London. You know, like you said, that buzz and that feeling of being in the city plays a real big factor as well. So I think that there's that need there to implement something in France, but I'm not sure what.
Yeah. I mean, again, you made a really great point there, but the whole bonus thing as well, the fact that we now don't have this bonus cap, which anyone not in the industry will be horrified by, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, traders and people can just earn multiples of their already rather quite high, you know, salaries, but I think that it gets a lot of bad press because it's very easy to give it bad press. Because at the end of the day, having this flexible cost base means that these companies can act quickly. So if things are going well, and this is the thing, you are bringing in a lot of money to the company. You know, if you're bringing in, let's say you're bringing in, I don't know, 10, 20 million quid to your company on a yearly basis. Do you think it's fair you get paid 30 grand? I mean, I would suggest no, it's not. I would suggest that you should get paid more because you're bringing in more. So, you know, from that perspective, what the way that the investment banks pay is they pay a base, and then there is discretionary bonus on the top of that. And that discretionary bonus can be completely discretionary, i.e. you've got no idea what you could get. Or it could be, which is more common, they'll say you have to do this, 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 and this, and then you'll get a decent bonus. But even then, it's subject to all sorts of things. And then there's clawbacks and all sorts. But anyway, the main point, though, here is that I think that, you know, France is doing its best to attract. And I think it's good, but I don't think it's enough to really dent London particularly, because London has the no bonus cap, plus it has that whole buzz thing as well.
Yeah.
And apologies if I've offended any French people listening to this, but it's just, this is, I mean, I love France, you know, yeah. But my dad lives in France. I don't know, just from talking to people in the industry as well, they all say it's like working in London is a real buzz from that perspective. So, yeah.
I've heard that a lot. Everyone always speaking about, you know, the sort of buzz that you get when you work in London. And I don't
think yeah.
it's something that can really be replicated by the sounds of it.
No. I mean, I love the idea. I think Paris is a wonderful place, really great place. Love it. I mean, I wish I could work there myself. Well, maybe I can one day, but, you know, I think it's a great environment. But yeah, in terms of investment banking, this particular industry, not quite so exciting, I don't think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, so we'll move on to next thing. So I'm going to make, I'm going to offend a lot more, having just offended loads of, you know, French people and Parisians in particular, I'm now going to offend fans of electric and believers in electric vehicles. So my, so what the story I've chosen today is from The Times, and it's all about a divide. There is a big divide, a north-south divide, not only in terms of economic prosperity, but also electric vehicle take up, because the, you know, the prosperous sort of southeast has a lot more kind of people buying or being interested in buying electric vehicles, and the infrastructure is a lot better as well in these kinds of places. So that led me to my unpopular opinion that I feel that we will not all go to EVs. I do not think that we will go to EVs, yeah. To 100% EVs, you know, by whatever, 2035 or whatever. I mean, I know that there will still be, it will never be 100% because people still have petrol vehicles knocking around, but in terms of sales,
yeah.
I do not think it will go to 100%. I don't think it should go to 100%, and I think it's impractical. And I think that a more reasonable scenario would be, let's say you have to do 50, you know, manufacturers have to have say 50% of their you know, their the models available being electric, being electric. And there's a number of reasons for that. So one is, I think that the charging, so I'll go through each one. So one is, I think that the charging infrastructure is not working now, and I don't think it is practical for the future.
Yeah.
The second thing is the batteries themselves, so the second is battery themselves. Third thing is the cars also, because of their depreciation. Then I think also there are problems with insurance and maintenance. Yeah. So going back on each one of those, I would say, so first of all, the charging infrastructure. At the moment, it's not great, especially if you live in a rural area, and or you know, depending on which part of the country you're in, some areas are very patchy, others are well covered. So the other thing as well is in terms of public charges, because obviously if you live in a place which has off-road parking and you could put in a box and charge, obviously you're all fine.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people do not have that, and they have to charge using a public network. That is not good at the moment. I would say that I believe that a charging infrastructure, a public charging network, is not necessarily an attractive investment for the long term.
Yeah.
I believe that battery technology would advance to such a stage that range anxiety will not be a thing. You know, we've already seen cars that have got 1,000 miles as a sort of like a tester.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that within the next few years, I would not be surprised to have batteries that have longer and longer and longer range. So in which case, range anxiety just won't be a thing anymore. So if you, as an investor, throw loads of money into a charging network and you build it up over the next few years, you're sitting on a, I say ticking time bomb, but you know, you're literally, the revenues from that will just go fall off a cliff suddenly when everyone starts buying these cars with bigger batteries.
Yeah.
So, or, you know, longer range batteries. So I think that I think that you need, in this scenario, you need investment by big companies with loads of money, like oil companies. Mm-hmm. So that's why you've seen investment in charging infrastructure by BP and Shell, for instance, because it's good PR for them, but also they've got the money that they can throw at it, and it doesn't, you know, make too much difference to them. Whereas if I was, let's say, a small company trying to build up a charging infrastructure, I think once I've got to a reasonable size, I would definitely look to be selling to an oil company or something. But I mean, what do you think? Do you think, you know, charging infrastructure, is it, do you think it's, you know, it's not as bad as everyone says?
Let's take Scotland, for example, which isn't as densely populated as London. Like, traveling between long distances, charging points aren't really available. So investing in that area would be a good idea in order to increase popularity in these areas. You know, but then simultaneously, like you said, range anxiety is going to become less and less over the years. So I think actually moving away from investments in charging would be a good idea, and looking to things like alternative synthetic fuel might be a better idea, which could be used in already existing vehicles. So maybe this reliance on EVs is going to, you know, decrease.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, moving on to the next bit of this, which is, so it's all kind of related. So the other concern I have is about the batteries themselves. So you've just talked about that, you know, the battery, the longer ranges. But my point is that we're already having a shortage of battery materials. And at this moment in time, I think it's something like the market, the percentage of EVs on the road, I think, is something like between 5% and 7%, something like that. We are already talking about shortages of battery materials.
Yeah.
What is that going to be like when it hits 30, 40, 50%?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's going to be a nightmare, and we don't have control over it.
Yeah.
China has control over most of the materials, the vast majority of the refining. And now, you know, the electric vehicles is churning out electric vehicles left, right, and center. So, but anyway, going back to the batteries themselves, the fact that we can't even really cope with making all the batteries that are needed now, let alone in a few years' time, I think is a massive red flag. Yeah. So I don't think that's going to be good. The cars, with regard to the cars themselves, you know, there seem to be more, I've seen a lot more things on social media and in the news and stuff about how electric vehicles depreciate horrendously. Now, okay, this may be an extreme example, but, you know, there's one I saw the other day, a guy on YouTube who had a Porsche Taycan said he's going back to petrol because he said the depreciation is ridiculous. That, you know, he's had an absolute nightmare. And I don't think it's just Porsche Taycan owners, but, you know, some of these vehicles are like 130, 140 grand new. You looked like you can get them, I mean, depending on their spec and everything, but you can get these things for 50 to 70 grand.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge depreciation. And I think this is only going to get worse because there are going to be more and more electric vehicles coming onto the market, because the thing is, the car manufacturers have to act maybe, I think, 3 or 4 years in advance, maybe more than that. And so what you're seeing now is the result of what of the efforts that they put in over the last, you know, four-ish years. Mm-hmm. So now, because of all the emphasis on the EVs a few years ago, we're just going to see more and more and more coming to market. So we're going to see more new EVs that everyone's going to have to buy. And if they don't, they're going to go, you know, they're going to get cheaper. Mm-hmm. That has a knock-on effect on the second-hand market. At the moment, you know, the second-hand market in the UK has got a lot weaker. So second-hand electric vehicle market has got a lot weaker. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see huge depreciation. Who is going to want to buy a car that will depreciate that badly in that short a space of time?
Yeah.
I just don't think so. But
you know, I think the practicality of EVs is just not really where it needs to be. I think that warrants also being higher because they're so different to traditional cars. I think that sort of makes it appealing if you can afford the luxury. But in terms of day-to-day use, I don't really, really know how practical they are.
I mean, I would say, A, I like electric cars. Mm-hmm. So I would like one myself. I want them to work. I want them to work. It's a bit like I like the idea of driverless cars and I want that to work as well. Yeah. But I just think that the practicality of sustainable, so, you know, bringing them to market, making the, you know, getting the materials to make the batteries that make the things go.
Yeah.
It's just, I just don't think it's practical. Mm-hmm. I mean, the day-to-day practicality of these cars is all right. It's just the more the, how to make them and how to make enough of them without them, you know, the value going all over the place. It's just, I just don't see it. And then if you put on top of that problems potentially with insurance, mm-hmm. because they're more expensive to repair. I mean, I've talked about this before, but if you have an accident in an EV, I believe that the law is such now, unless it's changed very recently, that, you know, you have to actually, where they put it in the yard to repair, it has to have a certain gap around it because of fire risk. And I think you have to keep it there for a week or something.
Oh, really?
Because there's still fire risk. And, you know, there was a time a few years ago when I had to take our car into, you know, not the petrol car, to we had a bit of a prang. And the insurance company said, okay, take it to this place. So we took it to this particular place where they do all the repairs, or they do the assessment and they do the repairs. I tell you, that place, you know, I said to you earlier, I had to take a tin opener with me to actually get out of the car, because their cars are parked so tightly together to get them into, you know, enough of them in there. You can imagine how popular it is when an EV comes in,
yeah.
because they just can't do anything. So it's a real, you know, there's the insurance, the cost of repairs, and then of course the maintenance, which I suppose there's less parts, but the problem is that you need people that are trained on EVs and repairing EVs.
Yeah.
So again, there's costs. So I just think that for the batteries, the recycling, the depreciation, the costs of the you know, the insurance, the maintenance, I just think that they're going to have to be more of a balance between electric vehicles and non-electric vehicles, because it just isn't going to work otherwise,
yeah.
in my opinion.
I think that its popularity might rise again, maybe when there's more choice, but I think that
now
there is a need, especially for families, to have a traditional car as well as an EV car. I don't think that solely relying on an EV car would work.
Yeah. So we'll see. Maybe we should get a follow-up podcast with Jake Sugar, because I know he's got a family. He's got, well, his family has been growing, and he's got a Tesla. So we should ask him to rebuff this. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Sia, for your insights today. We'll be back again tomorrow. with more stories. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
No problem at all. Have a great day, and have a great day to all of you who are listening. We'll be back again soon. Many thanks.
Bye.
Bye.